You should see on the screen, in the top left, it should say Paul is recording.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got the lights on today, so we can actually see what we're doing.
John has bypassed his meter. The electricity board will never know. The lights are on. There we go. And he's done it safely. Right, should we just go for this then? Marvellous. Right, okay. And we will go in five... Hello, everybody, and welcome to another E5 podcast. I'm your host, Paul Meenan, and I am here with the usual suspects. Please introduce yourself, my tag team partners.
Hello, it's David here, Sparky Ninja.
Hello, I'm JW.
It's us, it's the usual ones, and welcome to, is this part four of our surging debate that we have around SPDs? And we're going to kind of grow it today, aren't we, a bit, because we have another guest host on this from a company we're already familiar with. Could you please introduce yourself, sir?
Hi, I'm Sean Passant. I'm the technical manager of Dane UK.
So it's Dane UK. So this is kind of part two of their contribution towards the industry debate that has really got people going, because a lot of people want some quick wins. A lot of people want some common sense around surge and lightning protection, but it is genuinely a complex subject. And for me, and again, I'm just going to start off with an opinion, I think it's an area of our industry that we have probably ignored, maybe. Just gone, yeah, you're over there. But until it kind of biting our toes, we're not going to listen to you much.
Yeah, I definitely feel that it's not been entertained in any way for me on training, in books or anything. It's always been behind closed doors or shut away from me in any other journey I've been on, and I've had to look through the keyhole at it and think, crap, I'll have to spend some time on that.
Well, I've been on major infrastructure projects, like the early days of Crossrail and stuff, when we've done systems engineering workshops and the various like. And right at the end of it, when everybody's done and dusted, someone goes, oh, sorry, I forgot lightning protection. What are we doing with that? And the whole room just groans. And you're like, and they just don't want to entertain it, because it's just another thing that needs to be minuted, to be managed, to be worked, to be discussed. Oh, hang on, there's a clash between the cladding system and the down conductors, or there's a clash between the foundations and the electrodes for the lightning. And it becomes this thorn in the side that generally the delivery M&E manager gets. But what we thought we'd do is we'd bring in Sean today. So thank you for coming, Sean.
No problem.
And we would debate this because there's a bit of a background story to it. Now, me in my role as a mechanical electrical services manager, engineer, I've always known it as a standard called BS6651. Could you explain to us maybe a little bit about 6651?
Yeah, sure. So 6651 became a UK standard, a UK specific standard in 1985. And it was our standard that went right the way through to 2006. It was a very simple document. It was 140 pages in total. It contained a very brief risk assessment, but to be honest, hardly anyone ever did it. And it was quite a simple, nice, easy to use document that everybody remembers fondly and liked, because it was really, really simple and anyone could do it.
So why did we go? Okay, so we've obviously moved on from that, because two rules of thumb that I heard when I was first introduced to it was, all you have to do is worry about the tallest building, which was one of the rules of thumb or wives' tales that came from it. And it was always, don't worry about it. We just get a specialist in and they put some sort of tape around the building. Nobody gave it any credence at all, to be honest with you, which is a shame, because if you miss out a standard, you miss compliance, and then you wonder what weird things are happening. I'm learning that as well. It's obviously moved on from 6651 and a happy standard that people could enjoy into a far more complex suite of standards, which is the BSEN 62305 series. Do you want to give us a kind of breakdown as to what that is and what they are?
Sure. So BSC N6305 comes from an IEC document. So it's been adopted by Senelec, that lovely European committee. And we have a European normative document, that's the EN part. And then we have the British specific version, the BS version of that. It started in 2006. We're currently on the 2011/2012 version. It's a four-part standard. Fun fact, there was meant to be a fifth part, by the way, for testing and inspecting, but they never got around to writing it.
That would be good.
Yeah, so the four parts cover all the things that you would need to know, but when you compare it to 6651, individual parts of that standard are larger than all of 6651. So we now have part one, which is the general principles, part two, which is the risk management, part three, which is the life hazard and physical structures protection, and then finally we have part four, which is the electrical and electronic protection. So divided up into four parts, and each one needs to be considered when you put together a whole lightning protection system.
And is it fair to say part four is the one that deals kind of the one that ties in and marries surge protection within a building to the lightning protection system?
Well, actually, the type one devices appear in part three. So they are part of part three because they relate directly to life hazard. Interestingly, what part four actually says, and it's on page 16, note four, I think it is. It actually says that if you have a lightning protection system that only considers the type one devices, although 6305 doesn't call them type one devices, it calls them equipotential bonding SPDs, then it's only protecting the structure and life hazard. It is not protecting sensitive electrical equipment and electronic systems within the building. I think that's a sentence and a note from a standard that most end users are probably unaware of, and they've probably not ever been told that before.
No, I haven't been, but there you go. So here we go, lads. There's someone on who's quoting standards to us. God help us. What do they think this podcast is about, eh? Facts?
So it's interesting. You mentioned the equipotential bonding there. That's mentioned in BS7671, where we're told about the type one. I mean, is it considered the same as type one, or is type one, is the term type one just specific to a manufacturer category? What is...
So the term type one actually comes from a completely different standard altogether. That comes from 61643, which is the low voltage surge protection standard, and it sets out testing criteria and testing protocols, and that's where you achieve a type one device from. But yeah, it is exactly
are they the same equivalent?
They are, yes, they're exactly the same. An equipotential bonding SPD is in effect your type one SPD. Yes.
Awesome. Sorry, I was just looking at the exemptions criteria for 7671 because it exempts 62305 installations, and yet the two are inherently, they are codependent. When there is one, they must interact with the other. So, is it me, or is that a wire and regulations just kind of, I don't know, could we do better there? Is that an improvement in the wiring regs? We acknowledge the fact that a 62305 system will occur in a commercial, domestic, commercial, industrial, and some larger domestic installations, possibly, and that there is an interface, because I'm fed up with gaps occurring on site with the contractors. And this is where the standards need to be held accountable and the committees need to be held accountable, because there's two things you said so far, Sean, which fascinate me. You've said 62305 was going to have a part five inspection and testing. Now, I don't know about Dave, but in my personal experience, when I was on the tools, when I came through my learning, my apprenticeship and everything I did, when I got to my inspection and testing qualifications and my learning, that was a validation of my experience and my knowledge. And also it enabled me to look back and build upon everything I'd learned in a logical and analytic way. Now, on lightning protection systems, if you're going to have an inspection and testing standard, I would suggest that can only be a massive, massive benefit to the installers, to the end users from an assurance perspective. And hopefully also, you might be able to sneak in some cross with something like BS7671 for a main, so an electrical installation contractor, if you want to know, you know, there's a lot in these documents. There is a lot. And I'm not going to say I'm competent in the understanding of them. I would have to do more specialist training to develop that understanding. But if there was something in a part five that an electrical contractor could pick up and read and go, ah, I understand what's required of me. I understand these systems interfaces. That might not be a bad thing.
It'd be based on verification of an understanding on the 62305
yes
series,
but it's a way of teaching. It's a way of teaching, but the other way, because there's more than one way to skin a cat, and sometimes people don't learn in that normal progressive manner. Sometimes they have to build something and look and go,
it's interesting that it just was never done. Was there a excuse for that, or was it just a
No, there wasn't, and I wasn't. I'm involved with standards now, but I wasn't involved with standards then. I don't know why it wasn't ever produced. I'm just aware that in 2011, when we got the revised version of 6305, one of the official notifications was that, as a committee, we've decided we're never going to write and publish a part five as we initially intended to.
Does that technically mean that as an industry, you are satisfied with the current outputs of the contractor with regards to their verification of these systems?
Are they doing
a good enough job?
I would say that from my own personal experience, test and inspection of light protection system is the biggest issue that facilities, maintenance managers and end clients have with the industry. I would say it's the biggest single problem that they have. So I guess in answering that question, I'm saying, no, I'd quite like a part five. Thanks very much. So
I was going to say, can I publicly state that I would fully support a part five, and the sooner the better. So whoever's the chairman of these committees, please, on behalf of an actual client who pays money for lightning protection systems, please, can you get your finger out and write me a part five? Because it's something that I would like.
We all know from our industries that, you know, it's the initial verification and the testing of low voltage systems where we see the weakness in people's performance and the knowledge and skills. And if Sean knows his industry and he says he sees the same kind of trend where that's the area that shows that there's a weakness, then it's, yeah, definitely. I think we can all agree that that would be a good idea.
Yes, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, it is. It's something that should be addressed. There are parts of 6305 that do address testing. So, it would be remiss of me to not say there are bits that are in there. I don't feel those bits are in depth enough. And I think a dedicated section would be really, really kind of a good step forward. I'm not sure it'll happen, but we can keep our fingers crossed.
We can always wish, can't we?
Yeah. Yes.
I'm convinced the part five, I think, would genuinely help. All the experiences I've had with lightning protection contractors and the arguments and the debates of the gaps between the low voltage guys I just think it would work, to be honest with you. JW, what are your thoughts? Any questions at all?
Well, not any questions really. It's just that, I mean, I do domestic stuff, as people probably must know, and lightning protection is something that you pretty much never see on domestic properties. And occasionally you might come across it on sort of like a commercial place, like a church or something like that. And then the general thing then has been, oh, that's somebody else's job, or someone else does that. And it's some kind of mystery thing over to the side that no one actually gets involved with. But if you actually look in BS7671, it's actually referred to a lot of times, and although it's not actually in the scope, when you look through it, it says things like, oh, for such and such, please refer to 6305 and something else, look in 6305. So although it's not as part of that, it's actually referred to in it something like about 25 times in there. So
it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those things that you don't know anything about, but on the other hand, you probably should, because it's actually said,
well, that's the point.
Go and look.
For us to be considered as technically knowledgeable in BS7671, we're supposed to say we can understand the content. And if the content is saying you don't need to do this because of this, and if we don't know what this actually is, because it's some BS number that we can't afford to see or we don't understand, then how are we actually complying with what the book is supposed to actually achieve in the first place?
And if you don't mind, rant one of the podcast for me. It's I think I've said this before in podcasts, but I genuinely do not believe that if you want someone to comply with a standard or the intent of a standard, we all know that if you go online to BSI online and you want to buy a British standard, it comes up as anything between 150 to 300 odd pounds. If you're an electrical contractor just starting out or trying to grow your business, it's very difficult because in theory, you should know every British standard you're installing to. So how many thousands of pounds are you going to be paying out before you even turn the screwdriver? Never mind. I mean, I've actually, I'm not joking. I have employed specialist subcontractors and I've said to them, do you have a copy of this standard? And they have said no. It's that embarrassing. Hard. And I have had to, I have had a printed version. Luckily I have a BSI online subscription, but I've had a printed version where the guy who I've met has said, can I have a printed copy of it? Because his own employer didn't buy it. And yet they're engaged doing the work. And that we could make a series of podcasts called The Dark Side of the Industry, where we actually talk about the realities of how some contractors work and the things we expect them to do and they don't do. That's that first rant over. Oh, I feel so much better.
That thing with the price, though, actually, I just went there and I'd looked how much they would cost. If you go there now and buy all four parts of 63.5, £1,218.
Yes! Bargain.
There you go.
Stick it on the Christmas list, everybody. How much is that? 1,000?
218.
And the problem is that could just be a subject that people listening to this right now are interested in.
Yeah.
It's not their essential need to work, but they have an interest in working a bit better to explore an area, maybe to seek training, maybe to go with that list or someone later to train and go into that industry. But they need to have access to the industry first to understand it. Yeah. And that is immediate brick wall.
Well, you say brick wall, but Dane have a way around that brick wall, and we'll cover that a bit later on.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
But for those of you who want to are listening and want to buy your friends and family the ideal Christmas present that you could also benefit from, BSEN 62305 parts 1 to 4, 1,280 of the Queen's pounds. What a bargain.
Mm.
What a bargain. Mm. So there's a blocker straight away to industry growth.
And that is an excuse for most electricians.
Yes.
That's the thing. It's an easier excuse because they can go, oh, you know, reasonably practicable, man, money, and all this stuff. You say about literally where regulation relative to the nature of the work. You say, well, at this standard that is hidden away. It's just an excuse.
But Dave is bang on there. And it's, we always talk about competence relevant to the task and all and the nature of the work. If you make stuff prohibitively expensive and you don't authorize an industry and you have no controls other than after the horse has bolted, this is why a lot of specialist contractors have had no access to standards whatsoever, but are doing it. I know major electrical installation contractors that don't have copies of most of the standards they should be compliant with. And I speak from my experience as a client when I've gone out snagging, and when I snag I always code or quote the standard that they're not in compliance with. And you'll be surprised, you know, how many companies have done earthing installations, and when you say 7430 they go pardon. And or they build a substation, you go, are you earthing the fence? What for? Because 7430 says you earth the fence around the sub. Do we never done that before? I've been doing this 20 years. Like, but there's a clause in that standard that says if you build a metal fence around a substation, you bond it. No, I've never done that, mate. So then they bugger off and you end up getting your electrical contractor to do what they should have done.
Well, yeah, so the point is you end up having to educate them as well, don't you?
Yes.
I think in our industry and the nature of the electrical industry, we are always going to, given what we know of our industry, I think it would be wrong not to be in a consistent sharing, engaging, developing and emerging of our knowledge, because if the British standards aren't going to help us and they're not going to be accessible, the only thing we can rely on is healthy debate, factual knowledge, guidance notes, publications from the manufacturers, stuff like that to help them on that journey. And hopefully they'll see a benefit in reduced rework, less mistakes, better reputation, less comeback, do you know what I mean? Better warranties, all that good stuff. That's where the incentives are. That long term, but then again, that's an asset management mindset rather than a just get it in, get it done, get paid mindset. Just before we move on, unless anybody's got, I want to kind of go a bit more into. I'm going to happily admit on this, I'm not competent in 62305.
Oh, I agree.
I am not a practitioner of 6305.
As we go,
the geeking me wants to just be able to quote it verbatim. I just don't have the time in my job as a client, which annoys me. But I promise on this podcast, I will actually take some time to read, to highlight, and do my usual learning and CPDing of a standard. 62305 is in four parts.
Yes.
So we know part one is general principles, and it introduces how we design a lightning protection system, an LPS. There's part two is risk management.
Yes.
And it's not just physical damage, it's human life, loss of services, etc., which kind of crosses into the SPD four bullet points in the regs.
Yes.
Part three, physical damage to structures and life hazard again, but it has these four classes of protection. Is there any chance you can take us through these four classes of protection? Because I've heard of them, but my developed application of understanding and how
is
I would...
Is this the R1, R2, R3, R4s? Or is this something else?
Oh, there's two different things there. There's levels of protection, so and there's four subjects that you could potentially risk assess.
Yeah.
So when you're doing your risk assessment, there are four things you can look at. R1, which is loss of life. R2, which is really badly worded because it's described as loss of service to the public. But we should really think of that as business continuity. Can that building open up and do what it's meant to do? So I always give exactly the same example of this. If you take the kids to school, you're dropping them off, but the school has had some kind of issue overnight and the lights are off and the fire alarms are going, there is no way the head teacher is going to
function.
Exactly. So the building can't function. As a result of that, that would be an R2 thing. Then there's R3, which is loss of cultural heritage. Pretty straightforward. And then finally, we've got R4, which is loss of economic value. Now, R4 is a bit of a mystery. It's not one that people do very often. And again, I always use exactly the same example for that. If you were to take an aircraft hangar, on its own, a large metallic structure with a steel frame sitting on a large reinforced kind of concrete pad, it's not that much of a risk in terms of if it got struck by lightning. But if you put an Airbus A380 in it that's cost you a couple hundred million to buy, and you're going to lose millions with it flying backwards and forwards from Dubai every day, then you would consider it.
So is this assessment of risk then really also down to the business to take part in? Because who determines here what is economic value?
Yeah, so it is. And you need quite a lot of information to do that R4 risk assessment, which is one of the reasons it's quite unpopular, because you need to know things like amortization rates, mortgage rates, what is the value of the contents in the structure? What did it cost you to build the structure? What does it cost you to maintain that structure? So getting that level of information, I've got to be honest, is quite difficult. And the majority of lightning protection companies are fairly small. They tend to be, apart from one or two big names in the industry, they tend to be kind of family-run businesses with one single branch kind of thing, which I guess is similar to electricians. A lot of them are, you know, fairly small owner-operator type businesses. They just don't have the time to be trying to get that information. And as a result, they tend not to do R4 or even talk about R4 very much.
The trouble is on major projects now, if you just look at a bill of quantities, they should have all that information by default. And I'll tell you what, one thing I can see immediately that's a clash. So if you go on to an airport job, I can guarantee you the airport will have the unit cost of every piece of rebar, concrete, the labor rates, everything detailed in a spreadsheet, and it will be under lock and key by a quantity surveyor. The trouble is they won't release it because it's commercially sensitive information.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And that is an inherent clash with trying to get this R4 system done the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And to be honest, again, personal opinion, really, you should always be doing at least R1 and R2. And the reason for that is that, and I guess this comes from my kind of knowledge of the risk assessment and how it's built up, R1 looks at different things to R2. There are different types of risk. There are different sources of damage and types of damage that it is looking at. And R1 largely is going to result in you having more physical structural lightning protection.
This is loss of human life.
This is loss of human life. And the best way to cure that is to put more lightning protection on. R2 is going to drive your requirement for surge protective devices.
This is your services.
Exactly, because exactly that is your services. So you should always be looking at both of those as an absolute minimum. R3 is not always applicable, clearly. And R4 typically would be applicable. But if you've done R1 and R2 and it says, yes, you need a lightning protection system, it should be
there already.
Yeah. You're there already, exactly. So typically, and when Dane offered this as a service to people, we only usually do R4 if the result of an R1 and R2 risk assessment has said, no, you don't need anything, but the client still thinks there's actually something of value, either the nature of the structure or what's inside the structure is of enough value to warrant it happening. So that's when we do those.
So is that when... So there's a term, lightning discharge calc.
Yes.
Is that done as part of the R1 then?
All of that would be part of any risk assessment you do. You're still collecting the same data. So you're collecting, you know, how big is the structure? How long are the service entry lines that come into it? Whereabouts is it physically? So all of that kind of information goes in. And then other things, you know, how many people are in it? How long are they in it? That's one of the biggest single drivers, by the way, is how many people are in it and how long they're inside that structure.
For those listening then, is there any chance you could cover what a lightning discharge calc is and maybe how it links to SPD selectivity or selection? Or is that just too heavy for now? I don't know.
It would be quite heavy. Okay. You're looking at your level of flash density and the number of times that structure might see an event in the course of its lifetime, which you can establish that. That's something that can be established using risk assessment software. We have to use software because it's a horribly complicated calculation, by the way. It's horrible to do.
Do we have a preferred software out there? Is it is it like with the fire guys, they use Legion software for modeling of people in and out of railway stations? So you've got these little weird bodies that run around and...
Yeah, so there are only two that I'm aware of. One is called Dane Support Toolbox. It's made by a strange German company called Dane. We're pretty sure anyway, it's the most widely used software in the world for doing it. And the other version is called Strike Risk, and it's made by another company that are mostly from Nottingham.
So I've heard of that. Are these calculations modeled on a principal standard or something?
Yeah, they are. So all of that information comes in part two of the standard. If you put the same information into Dane Support as you put into FERS's Strike Risk, you should, in theory, get the same answer out. Neither company has any kind of input into that. It is all standards driven. And to be honest, there'd be no kind of gain in tweaking your software to do that. I'm absolutely sure that the guys at FERS would agree with that. There's absolutely no point in doing that because ultimately you'd get found out. People tend, on the whole, to have access to both of these packages. And if they were constantly doing one in one package and then checking it in another package and finding that they got different results out, then, you know, they would be on the phone very soon to one or other organization. So, they are largely the same. So it's all standards driven. And from there, it tells you if you need lightning protection, it tells you the level of lightning protection that you need. And that kind of brings us back to Paul's point about those four different levels. There are four levels.
Yeah. And this is math is in the Dash 2 standard, you say?
It is, yeah. And as I say, it's horribly, horribly complicated. And effectively, it's looking at three types of damage, which come from four sources of damage, which then lead us on to four types of loss. And then it's taking all of that information about that structure and working out a whole lot of them. So some of them are looking at really quite specific things like the risk of fire from a direct strike to the building. And then also another part of the calculation will look at the risk of fire as a result of an indirect strike to an incoming power or data cable. So it's molding
many variables.
Exactly, yeah, and it's molding all of those together to get an overall picture, and then it basically works.
I'm in 4.3 composition of risk components. Is it around there?
It is exactly around there. Yeah.
All right. I'm not gonna go through it either, but I just like to look at this stuff. Cool. That looks fun.
If you're looking in that part of the document, the important bit that you need to look at is 5.4. Note 2 is the most important bit. That's 5.4, the
note 2.
Yeah, note 2 and note 3. Note 3 is my favorite ever thing I've ever written ever read in a standard, because it just simply says that additional measures should be taken. It doesn't say what those measures are. It just says you should consider additional measures, which I think is an absolute genius piece of standard writing. So
it says when the damage to a structure due to a lightning may also involve surrounding structures or the environment, for example, chemical or radioactive emissions, then additional protection measures for the structure and measures appropriate for these zones may be requested by the authorities having jurisdiction.
Yes.
Fun.
Yeah, exactly. And reading that, what exactly does that mean? So, and I think that's
basically tells you don't know. That's basically what it says.
The trouble is, and I'll say this to anybody, and in my career, I have found it's when you go to a, and again, this is just in my experience, so I'm not speaking on behalf of any industry here. When you go to a group of people who have budgets and responsibility for managing of infrastructure and may not even be aware there's a need for competency in that management, and you try to explain to them this stuff you need to do for something you can't see, you can't smell, you can't really hear, and it's kind of, it could happen. It's very difficult to quantify in a why should we do this?
Yes.
And this is the trouble with earthing and bonding in general. It's easy to quantify earthing because that's for safety. It's easy to quantify bonding. Lightning protection, thanks to 6651 and the whole highest building in the land, malarkey, yeah. It's very, very difficult to break that mindset. And the industry did itself no favors by going around and saying, yeah, 6651, oh, there's just this risk assessment where you've got this sphere and oh, and it's the highest building, but you don't have to worry about it, get a specialist in, and done themselves no favors there.
6651 was so user-friendly as well, because you could walk up to any structure and immediately tell the client what he needed, because it had a make or break point, which was below 20 meters in height, you did one thing, and above 20 meters in height, you did something different. And it was always the same. So you could walk up to a building, and generally speaking, if it was 7 stories high, you did a quick, usually three meters a story, that means it's about 21 meters high. Okay, so this is what we're going to do, Mr. Client. Whereas if it was 6 floors, only 6 stories high or lower, you'd walk up and say, okay, we only need to do this. 6305 is very different because it is managing risk in an entirely different way. It's actually not even that fussed about whether your building gets struck or not. It is what are the implications if it does get struck. And it does look at it in an entirely different way. It's not looking at it saying, yeah, this building probably will be struck. It's looking at it saying, because of the nature of this building and what could potentially happen, you need to mitigate that risk by taking these measures. And that means you can't just look at a structure and say what it needs. So a red flag for anyone who is listening to this and ever employs a specialist light protection contractor, if they walk up to your building and start telling you exactly what it needs, pick the phone up and find somebody else, because they absolutely must do a risk assessment to work out the level of protection they need.
And that risk assessment is going to be based on them asking you a lot of questions.
Absolutely. We've got about a 14-page questionnaire that we send to people when people ask us to do a risk assessment for them. So we send them a questionnaire that wants to know an awful lot of information.
I have a question then, just for the end users of buildings, more importantly, really. So if you have an installation that it was done to 6651, is there any obligation or duty on people to bring it into compliance with 62305?
No, there's not. So there's absolutely no legal driver to make them do that whatsoever. No requirement, no responsibility to do so.
If you chose to, you could.
Absolutely, you could. Yeah. And usual kind of rules apply, don't they? When people talk about amending 50% or more of the structure, they tend to talk about upgrading it. So we would normally advise people on the same kind of thing as well. But otherwise, yeah, there's no requirement.
I mean, a lot of those variables of that risk assessment could have changed over time.
Which is another thing that I always tell people as well to do. Every 5 years, you should be having your lightning protection risk assessment relooked at, because buildings change organically.
Makes sense,
we know every single time that you have another service entering that structure, that is going to change the number of routes that Lightning could take into your building. And you need to revisit that. And again, I've got some standard things I always explain to people. I live in Stockport, and there's a building in Stockport that when it was built, I tendered for it at the time I was a contractor. Didn't win the job, and it was just an ordinary everyday piece of rentable commercial office space. And as soon as it was completed, that building was taken over by Sky, and they put a big glass kind of building on top of it, an extra floor, and they filled it with people to have three floors of it were used as a call center. So all of a sudden, that rentable office space, when we did the risk assessment, people probably thought it's got people in it from kind of 8 a.m. till kind of 6 o'clock at night, and from Monday to Friday. Now all of a sudden it's got a Sky call center in there, and that's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That changes the risk assessment. It needs to be relooked at because the level of Lightning protection will no longer be appropriate.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've never ever thought of it like that.
No.
No, I never. But you're absolutely right. I mean, with any other, let's be honest about it. If there's a change of use of a building, any facilities manager or infrastructure owner or manager of people immediately say, "Oh, we've changed use of the building. We've got to update the fire risk assessments." Hmm. You don't hear people harking on, "I need to change the Lightning protection risk assessments or revisit it." Most people don't even know where they file any risk assessments for it.
Again, your fire risk assessor should technically have this kind of trigger to say we need to update. If we change, as Sean's just said, all these variables that can change, you know?
Dave, I would love, and I know one or two people in the fire industry who are wonderfully, beautifully competent. Still, the challenge is out there for anyone in the fire industry who does fire assessments to come on this podcast. I will be gentle, but I can promise you this. I have met with fire risk assessors, and I've said, what would you like to see as far as paperwork, electrical certification, Lightning protection systems? It's very much the similar. Who remembers the dime bar advert Harry Enfield did in the early 90s, where they're waving the dime bar and go, do you remember your first dime? And the person scan, hey? They don't do it, because what's happening now in fire is they're using software. And the software is creating a series of questions with outputs for anyone to go along and hit an iPad, write a summary of what they see and all the rest of it, and it becomes rubbish. It's literally like almost just a wet finger in the air rubbish. They're not looking in the level of detail they should do. For me, a risk assessment should never be based on a reform order. It should be based on the guidance notes for the specific infrastructure. I mean, there's a government note on fire for transport premises. And even in that, it actually does mention Lightning protection systems as a potential source of ignition. But I don't think it does in the reform order. It just says sources of ignition.
I'm so glad you've mentioned Lightning as a source of ignition as well, by the way, Paul, because interestingly, it's a big issue and people do need to take more care with it. Interestingly, in 6305 itself, it only actually mentions ignition four times. And that's not nearly enough, given that if you look at something like BSEN 1127, which is the explosive equipment standard, they have a whole page dedicated to Lightning and the fact that a Lightning event in an explosive area will always lead to ignition. So it's important that people do think about it. We've done some work at Dane with the Institute for Fire Safety Management. And if you want, I can give you a contact there who may be prepared to come onto your podcast on another occasion. he may well be able to come on and do something with you.
In all fairness, I'm going to in the next couple of weeks when I get some spare time, I'm going to knock on some doors of some institutes and just say, come along, come and have a chat in the evening, come have a friendly chat, because it's definitely stuff that we need to know.
Yeah,
I think it'd be nice to put the information out there in a digestible form that people can choose to listen to or not. Chaps, do you have any questions for
just one to mention this? We've just obviously talked about the fact that 6305 never received its Fife inspection and testing. So is there anything in the series or in the industry that says about routinely re inspecting a installed system or doing this risk assessment. Is there anything within this?
Yeah, there is. It's a bit of a clash between the standard and some other things that are out there. So electricity at work regulations probably trump 6305. Mm. So most people are happy to continue with, because it's an electrical subsystem within a building, they're happy to continue with the kind of annual test and inspection of it. Interestingly, we still get a lot of people talking about doing it every 10 to 11 months, and that actually came from 6651. That's gone now.
Is that with variations of the
It year? It was variations of season and groundwater. It was always a bit of a red herring, to be honest, but it was there. So you should be doing it at least every year. 6305 actually suggests that for very low risk structures, you could put that out to 2 years. Although it does preface that, because it says that you should still carry out a visual inspection. But probably more importantly, it says for high-risk structures, you should be carrying out much more frequent visual inspection and also potentially some sample testing, and then do your big annual test. So if you're looking after a petrochemical site, you probably want to have someone in looking around that site at least on a 6-monthly basis, I would have thought, to have a look and see what's going on. So it gives a variety. It also interestingly talks about being competent, and it actually gives a bit of a description of that competence. And as an industry, generally speaking, we make test engineers have to sit a slightly higher level of their MVQ. They have to be MVQ 3 before they should really be doing test and inspections. So that's part of an upskilling program that the industry's been going through for a while.
I'm kind of looking forward to the day where we actually start saying level 4 was going to be the minimum standard for people doing this, because level 3 has been so badly watered down. Level three to me is the start of a journey still. Level two
is actually
just
more approachable now. The QCF was introduced. Level 4 is much easier to reach now as well.
I genuinely do believe all of the Seating Guild courses we do should be leveled up to a level 4 type. I think they should be a lot harder. I remember doing years ago the 16th edition amendments, and they were far harder in what they asked of people to understand and their knowledge and the pass rates. And I mean, the best electrical courses I did were level 4. Did 2400 design and verification, really ascertain and verify your knowledge, your application of the intent of these standards. Just a quick one, because Sean, you've just upset me. So on a side note, 11 months.
Yeah.
I shall definitely be making a phone call to my lightning protection maintainer on a Monday. I shall leave it at that, because 11 months is what I'm told.
Yeah. That went in 2006. That's not applicable.
What clause? Whereabouts can I find that, those golden gems to?
The testing requirements are in part 3, and I can't remember off the top of my head which part.
That's fine. Part 3, I will look for them when we finish this podcast. And
there's two sections of it, because I think some of it's in Annex E and some of it is in Annex D. Annex D is the part that deals with explosive structures, so that's got a little bit extra information in there. The 10 to 11 months was definitely only in 6651, and it does not form any part of 6305 at all.
It's amazing. Do you know what? Lightning protection, you could sum it up with one term: wives' tales. There are so many wives' tales. I've never seen a part of the electrical industry with more wives' tales in it.
The reason, though, I mean, our industry has not been keeping us informed or interested in this subject, Paul.
And to be fair... Yeah. The industry itself has not moved on as much as it should. So I think if you were to take a guy from about 1890 into most modern buildings, he would not have a clue what was going on. He certainly wouldn't understand the Wi-Fi control for the biomass boiler. But if you step up onto the roof,
it just shows how valid it is to stay up to date with this.
It does, yeah.
Oh, massive.
If you put that guy onto the roof to show him the lightning protection system, he would recognize 25x3 copper tape, although he would have known it as inch by an eighth, and he would recognize a B-bond. So those things haven't changed. Those things haven't changed for best part of 150 years. And I think as an industry, it's our responsibility, and I'm talking specifically the light protection industry now, it's our responsibility to try and drive that change on and to make that happen so that we drag the industry into the modern world. Light protection's one of the reasons, that electricians maybe have issues with it is that it's largely a non-electrical discipline. Most guys that install lightning protection have absolutely no electrical training and they are mostly mechanical. And mostly what they're worried about is, how am I going to reach that, and how am I safely going to be able to install what I'm installing? And it's lots of drilling, and it's lots of hitting things with hammers. There's very little electrical work goes on.
Which makes you wonder how testing happens if they haven't got, you know, if the majority of people installing don't have that electrotechnical.
Yeah,
well, it kind of makes you realize why they didn't want part five. Because they didn't want labourers and abseilers and various other blokes having to
have that
listen.
Level.
I'll tell you a story. So I was on a project. It was a brand new London Underground station build. It was a big metal clad building, and there was a lightning protection system, down conductors to electrodes all around the building. And the chap who was installing it was basically down to test it. And I remember going, oh, my God, he's testing it. Great. I don't know how to test these systems. Fantastic. I'm assuming he's going to use a 3 or 4 probe test and look at the resistance for the electrode or do something. And this guy basically took a mega and he took one of the probes and stuck it in the mud. And the other one, he put it on the tape. And he was putting it on 500 volt insulation resistance. And I was just like, I was standing there going,
okay, hang on.
Is that the way? Yeah, I know. It does. It stops you dead and makes you go, what? Then I said to him, I said, oh, wow, fascinating. What are you doing? He says, I'm reading continuity. And I was like, but you're on insulation resistance.
Yeah, no, you're not.
And he was like, and I went, do you know how to, don't be rude, but do you actually know how to do earth electrode testing? And he just went, no, not really. I just got shown you by some other bloke, and I was just like,
"Yeah, that would."
That's where there's definitely a need for people who are. For me, when you mention part five, I've got this bull by the horns now. I have no problem with a mechanical guy, a labourer doing the manual work to install an LPS, but when you are bringing into use and commissioning competently an electrical safety system, there must be some inspection and testing guidance for use by competent persons.
It's the same scenario we had in 7909, but we have that need for a technical competence because of the certification bar. But a lot of the installation work is done by non-electricians. The rigging and the actual erection of the system is carried out by non-electricians, but they need that verification, and that is in 7909.
The testing, I have to say, and safe earth testing does form part of their level 2 and their level 3 MPQ. So they should certainly have those skills and capabilities and have those competencies. So if someone was using the meter badly, I guess you would say you're only ever as good as your worst guy.
You've mentioned this MPQ. Is there a specific qualification number I can look for?
There is an MVQ that is delivered by the CITB at the National Construction College at Birch of Newton. So that is where the apprentices go. And if they don't do it as an apprenticeship, they can do it as a, what's referred to as an adult learner, and then do the on-site assessment route. So they're the two routes to getting their CSCS skilled workers card.
Okay. Lightning conductor engineer apprentice.
It's lightning conductor engineer, and then there is one as well for steeplejack, but they are different courses. So.
Oh yeah, and steeplejacks, lightning conductor engineers, and steeplejacks.
Yeah, there's two different courses. Oh,
cool. So, JW, any thoughts or questions? John obviously is domestic, henceforth we are talking about stuff that would normally go on commercial industrial, but there is a violence behind the silence, JW. any thoughts?
Sorry. Yeah, so lightning protection isn't something you generally see on domestic at all. I've never seen it on a domestic property, and it's not something you'd even really consider there, but so you do tend to see it on the buildings.
Quite a lot as a lightning protection contractor to look at domestics, but price and inconvenience quite often puts people off. So whilst we're telling stories, back in my contracting days, I did a domestic installation on a house in the middle of the Ashdown Forest in Sussex, and I've never had so many phone calls from a client ever. At one point, he actually said, your guys are on my roof. What are they doing up there? And I kind of said, well, we're going to kind of be on your roof if we're installing lightning protection. And he, in a kind of a rather incredulous voice, he said, you didn't tell me that when you came and gave me the quote. we didn't tell you we're going on the roof. So I wasn't quite sure what he expected we were going to do. But yeah.
Well, some domestics don't even anticipate the cables have to be buried in the walls, don't they? So
unfortunately, yes, there are certain places where people expect, oh, can you put a new socket here? And then they expect the wires to magically appear in the wall and don't have to actually do anything.
You haven't found the screws, John, you haven't found the magic invisible cable yet. Is that not in that big box of rubbish that you've yeah, it's isn't it awful when you go into someone's house and they go, yeah, can you put, yeah, listen, I remember once working for British Gas, and this family had brand new carpets put in, and this woman said, oh, yes, enjoy, I'm going out to work. And I went, just to let you know, madam, I'm going to put a little box on your wall here, it's a spur, and I'm going to lift up the carpet and put a cable into where the new boiler's going. She went, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. Otherwise, the boiler won't work. She went, no, you're not. These are brand new carpets. You cannot lift up my floors. Well, then you don't have a boiler working. You must make it work. Can't you just make it work? Well, I can give you an exercise bike and let someone pedal to generate energy if you want, but you need a cable. And it's mind-blowing, the mindset of the domestic homeowner. And yet, I'm going to say my little piece. Domestic homeowners, when it comes to boilers, isn't it amazing? Can't touch, don't touch, gas, woo. With electrics, it's there's a lot of work we need to do with hearts and minds of domestic homeowners regarding electricity and electrical safety, never mind in the commercial industrial for lightning protection. Now, moving on from that, so before we do, is it worthwhile telling everybody that if you can't afford the bargain £1,280, of which I'm sure while we've been speaking, Mr. Ward has already shelled out hard-working cash to buy these wonderful bargains, there is another way of learning about lightning protection systems. And I believe Dane have published a book. Sean, would you like to tell us a little bit about your wonderful book?
We do, yeah. It's lovingly referred to within Dane as the Bible, but it is known as the Red Book. It is published. It has a unique ISBN number or whatever you have to do to get a book published. It's downloadable from our website, which is www.dane.co.uk. Nice and straightforward. It's an absolute treasure trove. If you are nice to your local representative, he may give you a nice bound red hardback copy of it.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah. There is a nice hard bound copy available.
Bucket list added.
I was going to say, I think John might need one to lift up his lights a bit to proper.
I'll do the corporate bit and show. I have my copy here at my side at all times. As you can see, it's a thick, weighty.
It's a thick beast. It's
how many pages?
I've never counted, but let me just have a look. 488.
Yeah, 488 pages of just glorious CPD, and every page you can write at the bottom, I don't get it, and just keep reading until you ask more questions and listen to these podcasts and go to Dane.
I had a good read of it when I flew to Germany a couple months ago before all this nonsense hit and with the COVID, and I had to read it because I was just reading some of my downloaded PDFs. I'm one of those guys that if I get free resource, I've got to take that and then I'll review it later on. But I found that I could just pick it up and I just learn something each time. It's got great illustrations, great examples, and the pace is pretty good as well. You don't have to read it front to end. You can just jump into any section. It's well broken. It's actually broken down into bits, and I believe you can download each bit first, can't you? From your website, or download the whole thing.
You can either download it in sections or the whole thing.
I have found it when I had a skim through it. I thought, one, this is a great place to debunk and give more clarity, but also if you're a teacher as well, when you want to go on that journey of learning, you can go on that journey of learning, but also extract key parts. I would love, as I said, part five, inspection testing, I would love there to be a simplistic way of stitching lightning protection, surge protection into the hearts and minds of 7671 installers. So the 7671 wiring rigs, electricians know transient overvoltage protection like they would an MCB.
Mm. Yes.
That would be great. If we could get there, the industry, the electrical contract industry would be in a great place. Rather than having one bloke over there who kind of knows about it, if we can understand the suite of methods of protection we have for buildings, persons and property, and that includes transient overvoltage, surge, lightning protection, and there's an easy common framework, I think that would be a good thing. Sean, I believe, Dane, you guys offer training, or you're building a training centre?
Academy. Yeah, so we've got an academy, which is, I would say, about 75-80% built. We had to stop because of COVID-19, I guess, like all kinds of things did. That eventually, once it's up and running, we'll be doing a mixture of online courses and also attendance courses. It's going to be my responsibility, which is a bit onerous, I guess. And that is intended to teach people the basics about lightning protection, about surge protection. And then also for some people who really want to know some of the more kind of in-depth topics, isolated lightning protection, getting into kind of data SPDs as well, which is always a kind of a murky topic because it's quite a bit more complicated than the LV power stuff. Mm. So, and there's going to be a range of sources of kind of learning there. Some of it will be presented, some of it will be hands-on. So you'll be able to terminate some conductors and physically touch SPDs installed on the wall. I feel sorry for the electrician that's going to be doing the install because he's going to have lots of people looking at his work. And you know what sparkies are like. They always look at someone else's work and say they could have done it better or different. So his work is going to be inspected by hundreds and hundreds of people. So I do feel sorry for the poor chap.
Okie doke. Chaps, do we have any questions? Because what I want to do, if it's okay with you guys, I want to kind of wind this up because I think there's quite a lot more that we probably should be talking about. So rather than having a three and a half hour episode.
I'd like to talk more about training and the progress for electricians to get into this. And I think that's a good area for another time.
Okay. All right. Well, what we'll do then. So, John, do you have any final thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I think just that although it's something that most electricians never actually looked at before, it is definitely something that at least you should have some at least basic understanding of, because say it is referred in BSM 671 a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And it's often the case that it says, oh yes, just have a look at 62305. And obviously if you don't know anything about it, you're not going to be able to actually make use of that.
Indeed. Yeah. Dave?
Again, it's one of our agendas here is to try to obviously level up people, electricians, just to kind of give them this kind of platform to talk about things that they may not be familiar with. And that's just as much the case for ourselves here. I look forward to this academy opening up. I look forward to coming along and actually, you know, checking some of the stuff out.
I was going to say form an orderly queue, because I think we'll be at the front. We will be at the front of it.
We'll be
knocking on door going, can we come in? Don't really get
in
it
now. You know, we'll offer to finish the painting. And then
we'll all leave with our red book. Yeah, going, oh, right. That's
the point here. And this, you know, this might be a great opportunity, you know, to kind of push a bit more support for electricians. Because as John's just said, you know, this if the numbers in our book is applicable to our work, and that means it's applicable for us to consider for our clients, especially if the risk assessors aren't doing that for the client, who else will? You know, if we are appointed the service to think about electrical risk, and if that electrical risk is a source of ignition, which we've touched on in this discussion, we've got to consider that. And if those dots aren't going to be joined by the fire risk assessor or his peers, then if we can get some support for electricians to understand that little bit of risk, that little bit of information, they can just throw that in a discussion with the client, and that might make the client ask more questions from the right people.
Yeah, totally agree. Sean, please come back and do another one of these. I think we've got a lot of chit-chat still left to do. So if it's right with you lads, I'm going to wind this one up.
Okay, thank you for time, guys. It's been great.
So, thank you very much, Sean, John, legend, Dave, legend. And until the next one, which will be probably a week after this, thank you for listening. Thank you. Please like and subscribe on all the social media channels or comment below. We'll also put Sean's contact details in the YouTube descriptors so you can contact him directly. And when the Dane Academy is open, we will also update this to ensure that the information and all the course booking is in the descriptors as well. So until the next one. Thanks for listening, and take care of yourself and each other. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.